Forensic Friday. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson with us. Good morning, Ray.
Morning, Jack.
Tell us who you brought with you. We have a large cast this morning.
Well, we do. And the reason that we almost always bring a group is because there are a lot of people involved in these in cases that we deal. But today we have Brad Bryant and Aspen Carlisle from our office. They're prosecutors, and Sergeant Ron Keaton, who is the supervisor of Lexington's Police Department's Collision Reconstruction Unit, CRU.
Okay.
And we want to talk a little bit about a case that occurred in 2004. The defendant in the case is named Ryan Lugers, and he caused somebody's death and somebody's serious physical injury. But the main reason we really talk about vehicular homicides is the people. It's people are asking me more about vehicular homicides, I think, than almost anything that
really?
We do. Yeah, and what we want to be able to do is talk a little bit about how the collision reconstruction unit works, what happens when there's a what they call a call out to a scene, and how that affects people in our office. And the way we want to do that kind of is to let Brad kind of introduce us to this Ryan Lugers case that occurred, that he and Lou Anna Redcorn prosecuted. So,
Brad, I didn't know you'd been around that long.
Yeah, I'm an old-timer.
You are an old-timer. Well-preserved, isn't he?
Well, much, yeah, clearly.
Doesn't look that old.
Thanks, Jack.
So set it up for us, Brad.
Okay, so back on November 13th of 2004, the victims, William and Joanne Nichols, were sitting in their car, and they were in a line of traffic stopped at the stoplight. They were inbound on Versailles Road in front of the airport. They weren't at Man of War, but there's a stoplight before you get to Man of War. And they were the last car in a line of cars waiting on the light to turn green. And the defendant, who'd been basically drinking all day, was coming inbound Versailles Road, driving a GMC pickup truck. And he never saw the red light, nor did he see the Nichols car, because he plowed into the back of it and pushed it into the car in front of them. And it basically reduced that Toyota Corolla the Nichols were sitting in. It looked like a garbage can. And unfortunately, Mr. Nichols was killed. He sustained some pretty serious injuries that led to his death. He had a fractured spine. He had punctured lung. He had broken his arm. And his wife, who was driving that day, she had some subdural hematomas just from the collision itself. I mean, the collision was so strong that it put the back seat into the headrest of the front seats of the car.
What about the vehicle that was in front of theirs? Were there injuries in that car?
Everybody else was lucky. There were no injuries in those vehicles. And I think some of that's due to the fact that some of the people saw the headlights coming and realized that this guy wasn't going to stop. So they started kind of moving when they heard the collision. So it probably saved the people in the vehicles in front. It turns out that this kid, his blood alcohol level was a 0.20, which is about 2.5 times the legal limit of 0.08 in our state. And
how old was the defendant?
He was old enough to drink, so about 21, right in that age.
Yeah. Okay, so you have this collision, serious collision. Ron, from the perspective of the collision reconstruction unit, what happens from an investigative standpoint?
Generally, when we have a serious collision, such as Brad was talking about, the collision reconstruction unit gets called out to the scene, and we come out and evaluate what we have there at the scene.
Does that happen even if there's not a death? Does it happen or does there have to be?
We get called out if there's a death or a serious injury where there's potential for a death.
Okay.
Or a potential for a felony assault charge.
Okay. All right.
So we come out to the scene, we evaluate the scene, we look at the damage to the cars, we investigate the injuries, look at marks on the roadway, and make a determination based on, you know, the definitions in the, under the law, if there's going to be a criminal case involved.
Okay, now let's so Aspen, we get called out. We get an email from the police department, from Ron Keaton or from whoever is the supervisor in charge. We get a call out. Now, what does that mean?
We do. It means that we respond to the scene as well. Usually the injured or deceased party, well, the deceased parties will be still at the scene when we get there, but usually the injured parties are already on their way to the hospital, but we respond to the scene as well.
So what's the value of going to the scene of a vehicular crash that we may very well end up prosecuting? What value from the prosecutors?
Well, if it does end up in our office, nothing can replace seeing it firsthand. And so you get to see the cars exactly where they were, the debris in the road markings, and all of those become important later on.
Well, one of the things that happens now is when we get a vehicular kind of a case, you mentioned definitions, Ron. Now, this guy, Brad, was charged with murder.
Yeah. Correct. They the police made a decision to charge him with murder.
How's that work? How do you decide whether it's murder? Or what are the different choices or possibilities?
Well, Ron mentioned definitions.
Yeah.
I haven't ever seen or been involved in a case in which I believe that the driver that caused somebody's death in a car crash intended to cause their death. So, but that's not the only kind of murder there is in Kentucky. There's something called wanton murder. Now, you got to go to the definition of what in the world does wanton mean. Mm-hmm. And here's what it means. It means that you perceive the risk that your behavior, drinking to the level of .2, could cause somebody serious physical injury or death. You consciously disregard that risk and do it. It does cause somebody's death, and your behavior manifests extreme indifference to the value of human life. Now, if the behavior of Ryan Lugar's fit that definition, then he's capable of being charged with wanton murder, and that's what happened here. So let's walk through what Ryan Lugar's did. He's jacked up to .2 blood alcohol level. He gets behind the wheel of this GMC, I guess, pickup. Was it pickup?
Yeah, it's a heavy-duty pickup truck.
Yeah, and then took off. Now, does driving under that sort of an alcohol level, Jack, could that constitute serious physical injury or death to somebody?
Of course.
Yes. Do you consciously disregard it by doing it?
Yes.
And does that manifest extreme indifference to the value of human life? The answer was yes.
So it fit the criteria.
It fit the definition, so he's charged with wanton murder. Now, we went to trial with this guy, and tell us a little bit about that, Brad.
Well, we went to trial in October of 05, and the jury, they came back, he was originally charged with murder for Mr. Nichols' death, assault first for the injuries to Joanne Nichols, and then DUI. But the jury, after deliberations, they came back and convicted him of manslaughter second in the death of Mr. Nichols and assault second for the injuries to Ms. Nichols. And of course, they convicted him of DUI. But probably the biggest thing was, I think the jury probably equated the .2 alcohol level with just the wantonness and didn't agree that that was enough to say that that also was extreme indifference to the value of human life.
Could you make a case for, and maybe he did, I was so drunk, I didn't know what I was doing.
Voluntary intoxication is not a defense in these kind of cases. No.
Really?
Yeah. that's otherwise
everybody would make that.
Well, a lot of them.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's take a break. Person along with Assistant Commonwealth Attorneys Aspen Carlisle and Brad Bryant and Sergeant Ron Keaton from the Police Department with us this morning. And Ernie, good morning.
Yes, sir. My name is Ernie Nichols. I'm the son of William Nichols.
I'm glad that you called, Ernie.
I would like to ask Mr. Larson to please mention what can happen when judges, the latitude judges have within altering sentences. He was sentenced to, I forget how many years, 16 years, I think it was, in prison. And Judge Gary Payne commuted it down to a one-year work release, which back then was totally ridiculous, and it still remains totally ridiculous.
Well, now that you mention it, that was going to be one of my deals. It's this guy went to trial. He got convicted of manslaughter in the second degree, with the penalty of which is 5 to 10 years, and they sentenced him to what, Brad?
The jury gave him a sentence of 9 years on that.
Yeah, and what about the assault for his wife?
They sentenced him to 6 years on that and recommended it run consecutive.
Okay, so that means that the jury listened to all of the evidence.
Right.
And they recommended that this guy serve 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, our sentences in Kentucky, there is absolutely no truth in what sentences are. And the jury thought they were doing 15 years, and Gary Payne ought to be ashamed of himself.
I agree with that 100%.
And he sentenced the guy to serve 12 months in the county jail. And did he get work release? Is that what you're saying?
He never served any time in jail. He got work release is all he got. Right. And 5 years probation, I believe it was, after that.
Yeah.
The big thing we like to do on this show, Ernie, is highlight victims. And I'm glad that you called.
Now, what's your relationship to this?
Son.
I'm William Nichols' son.
Yeah. And so you're a victim.
Yes, sir.
You were a victim when you lost your dad, but then did you feel sort of re-victimized?
Still, yes.
And still do?
Yes, my dad's still gone.
Yeah.
I mean, I went to every day of the trial, and I listened to everything they said, and it just floored me when I found out Judge Payne had commuted his sentence. I found out on one of the local news channels. That's how I found out.
That's a horrible way to find out.
Yeah. Well, that's how I found out.
Well, any rate,
I'm sure Mr. Larson remembers me. I met with him a couple of times about it.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. One of the things that some of the most angry people that we ever deal with, Jack, are the survivors of homicide victims.
Mm-hmm.
Who feel like the criminal justice system is really not anything but the criminal system because they don't believe there's any justice in it.
Is that the way you feel, Ernie?
Oh, yes, sir. I went to every minute of the trial. The only thing I didn't attend was the formal sentencing, and now I wish I had, because that's I found out after the fact that that's where the sentence had been changed, and I wasn't there for that. I went to every minute of the trial. And Mr. Lugar's, I can't, it was indefensible. He blamed everybody in the world, if Mr. Larson remembers. He blamed his dog. His dog was with him.
His dog? His dog right. was with him. Are you serious?
One of his defenses was his dog got down the floorboard and got on the accelerator.
Yeah.
That was just one of his, he wanted four or five defenses that he had.
Well.
It was awful. But anyway.
This is the kind of thing, Jack, that causes police and prosecutors to be big-time advocates for victims of crime versus the characters that commit the crimes. You know, I've always asked, how do you continue to do your job? And I said, well, I spend most of my time trying to pick victims up, dust them off, and send them into the rest of their life. I don't really spend a lot of time worrying about the people that put themselves in that
position. Let me just say, Miss Redcorn did an excellent job prosecuting that case. I mean, I can't imagine. It was a slam dunk as far as I could tell. I don't know that much about court proceedings, but it sounded like a slam dunk to me. And basically what it comes down to, she wasted her time.
Doing
a great job.
Second degree manslaughter?
Right.
When that was made known, how did that make you feel? Were you shocked, disappointed, angry, all the
above? I was aware that I don't think in Kentucky anybody's ever been convicted of murder in a DUI thing, have they?
There hadn't
been many.
No, not many at all. In Lexington, we've convicted about 11 people over the number of years that I've been doing this.
Okay, I'm going to take a break. Hey, listen, Ernie, I appreciate you calling. Now, obviously, this is very personal to you. If you hear anything else in the next 25 minutes, then you want to get back on with us, please call us back, okay?
Yes, sir. Thanks for listening to me.
Okay, thank you. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T. Sergeant Ron Keaton is with us this morning from the Police Department, Aspen, Carlisle, and Brad Bryant, Assistant Commonwealth's Attorneys, along with Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson. Ray?
Ron, tell me about the kind of training that the people that are participate on the Collision Reconstruction Unit have to go through before they can be a member of that group.
The training the member has to go through is a 240-hour course. It's generally held in 3 2-week periods. It's a very intense course. You go over a lot of physics. There's a lot of math involved. That just gets you your basic certification as a reconstructionist. There's other specialized schools that investigators can go to, such as bicycle and pedestrian investigations, motorcycle crashes, commercial motor vehicle crashes, and then there's the list just goes on and on and on of all the different classes in energy, because there's a lot of force and energy involved in these crashes to help you figure out, determine speeds in these collisions.
So one of the things that's very interesting to me that I've learned from these guys is we call them vehicle versus pedestrian collisions. That sounds a little antiseptic.
Yeah.
But when a vehicle hits a pedestrian, typically the pedestrian goes up over the hood.
Yeah.
And where on the windshield a pedestrian will hit is an indicator of speed. Is that accurate, Ron?
It can be. There are instances you got to look at the front end of the car, the way how high does the car sit, because the pedestrian will go over the center of mass of the vehicle, and also the center of mass of the pedestrian determines how that pedestrian flies over the car. So if you have a head strike on the windshield, there's a standard based on testing and cases that you can come up with a pretty good range of speed, but you got to be careful whenever you use those formulas and that determination.
For example, when we're called to a scene and we see low on the windshield, mm-hmm. then we can sort of guess at that point that it's not a high speed. But if it's up on top of the windshield, then the speed is higher. I'll tell you something that happened to me a Friday, two Fridays ago. My wife and I go out to eat and go to the movie almost every Friday.
You're a good husband.
Yes, I am. Yes, don't ask her. And we were coming in Richmond Road, there where Fontaine comes in and Walgreens is there. And it was congested because the football game at Henry Clay had just concluded. And we were going, I don't know, 30 miles an hour, 35 miles an hour in the right lane. And all of a sudden, some yo-yo comes sprinting across the street. And I'm telling you, I guess I slammed on the brakes, but I guess I missed him by less than a foot.
Gee.
And it just absolutely... I
tore you up.
I was just shaking
after
that, because I know at that point, if I had hit him and injured him, next thing I know is I'm going to be at the emergency room giving blood. I'm going to have to go through all that, just because that's kind of the thing that happens. happens. Mm-hmm. How do you make those kind of decisions, Ron, about whether or not it's a crime or whether or not it's an accident, as we say?
Well, when we respond to the scene, we try to find witnesses and locate them to see what they've got, what they may have seen. We look at the cars, look inside the cars for any evidence of impairment.
Impairment meaning alcohol or drugs?
Alcohol or drugs. Right. Basically conduct a DUI investigation because that could be a factor in the collision. You try to talk to the driver to see what their story is, what happened during the crash, previous to the crash. And you just look at all the different factors that are involved and make a determination based on those factors and the evidence that you have at the scene as to whether or not this is a collision that was caused because the person just wasn't paying attention or didn't have an opportunity to avoid the collision, or if there were factors involved such as high rates of speed along with impairment. And the more of those things that you have together, you start building that case, you start to see, okay, this is going to be more of a criminal case, because we all drive down the street every day, but we all don't drive down the street at 90 miles an hour impaired with a 0.20 blood alcohol level.
Talk about that a little bit, 0.20 would not necessarily be the same to everybody, would it? What I mean is in terms of their behavior?
Correct. Some people have a higher tolerance, either because they're bigger or because
they drink more. Yeah.
And we had a case like that here a few years ago where the defense attorney tried to make that argument about his client. But she was a very small, very petite woman, and from the outside, just looking at her, she really didn't show a lot of signs of impairment, which...
Well, what was her level? Do you remember?
Level was a 0.18, but she also had pain pills and sleeping pills in her system.
That was going to be my next question. They don't show up in the alcohol test, right?
They don't show up in the alcohol test, but when we take blood from an individual that's been involved in one of these collisions, we send it to a private lab out of state, and they test for a wider range of substances, and we get it back usually within a couple of weeks.
And so if they're jacked up on alcohol and painkillers and antidepressants, you're going to know.
Right.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That's becoming a bigger and bigger deal, drugged driving.
Right.
Hey, what about drowsy, by the way? You see those orange signs? Brad here is a U of L football fan.
No.
And you see these signs, these orange signs they have out there that have the printing that goes across. What a lousy idea, because we're coming up on the University of Louisville, seventh ranked. And you know what the sign says?
What?
Are you prepared for a disaster?
Oh, great.
Yeah.
This is Jim. Good morning, Jim.
Yes, I was wondering a couple of things here. Approximately how many beers can a legal person, a person drank legally before he gets on the road? That's one question.
All right.
Is it one beer, two beer, three beers? You know, what's the legal amount that you don't have to worry about getting in trouble?
All right. What's the second part of the question? And we'll let you hang up and listen.
The other question is, in a court of law, is prescription drugs ever brought up? If you know you're taking prescription drugs and you shouldn't be driving a vehicle, is that brought into account?
All right, you listen to the answer. How many beers can I drink and drive?
That depends on the person. I mean, and that's a good wimpy answer, but that's a fact.
Yeah. What about drugs? If I have a prescription for those painkillers, does that figure into how you're going to charge me?
Well, the whole question, you know, there's a little label on most of those things that say, do not drive and take this medicine, or don't take this medicine and drive. And the question is, are you impaired? And it has if you're within the, what do they call that, therapeutic limit, typically no. But by the same token, you got to pay attention to the label on the prescription bottle.
We're taking a break. 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590. Email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. I like these shows where we can just talk about, you know, we can talk about a specific case, but we can talk about sort of a general problem, and this has been one today. This is David. Good morning, David.
Hey, good morning, Jack.
How are you?
Cooler than I have been this week.
Oh, good.
It's a lovely morning outside.
This is David Guess. He went to the military academy over in Millersburg, and as a result, he is the only guy that I know, except for Ray Larson, that has shoes that you could actually shave in the reflection of his shoes. Anyway, go ahead, David.
Well, I just wanted to ask Ray a question. Once he has been given, the police have reported to him what they feel the causes of the accident, what's been going on, how does he and his office decide whether or not to prosecute the case? And I'll go ahead and hang up and just listen.
Okay, David, go shine some shoes.
All right.
That's actually a really good question. How do you decide what you're...
Well, it's all the one issue that we have to deal with is every collision a crime? And that's because David had a sister-in-law who was killed in a car crash, and the driver of the vehicle was not charged, and
right.
Her family was very angry at me, probably still is. And it had to do with a guy that was driving a home ice truck and ran a red light. And the question is, you don't charge everybody that runs a red light, do you, Ron? If they're in a crash and hurt somebody?
No, we don't.
Why is that?
Under Kentucky law, we have to witness violations and misdemeanors. So we can't charge someone for running a red light. If they run the red light and they kill someone, we have to ask, is that conduct, does it fall into those definitions like we discussed earlier? Mm-hmm. Is that in and of itself enough to charge somebody with that crime for a homicide, a vehicular homicide? So we look at all the different factors, such as impairment, running a red light. We have collisions where we have people that they become fatal collisions because somebody gets killed. And once we look at all the factors, there's no impairment, they haven't violated any traffic laws, then that is not a crime.
Yeah.
So we don't end up charging anybody.
And in this case of David's relative, there was no impairment, I assume.
Well, here was the situation. The guy ran a red light in this truck. He had marijuana metabolites in his urine.
What does that mean?
Well, Brad, tell us what having metabolites in your urine means.
It means that you have probably smoked marijuana within the last 4 days.
So that's number one. But okay. if it's in your urine and not in your blood, then it's not affecting your brain.
It hadn't been recent enough.
That's correct.
All right.
Now the other part is that this guy had half of a earphone, one of the buds, I think they call them.
Yeah.
In his ear. And did that constitute, in our opinion, did that constitute some way he ought to be charged with a crime? And we made the decision in our office not to.
Okay.
I said, if you want somebody else to look at it, they can. And they did. And the guy was ultimately, I guess, charged with reckless homicide and pled guilty to that and was given...
Diversion.
Yeah.
What's that mean?
That means he went home.
Oh.
Yeah.
Doug, good morning.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. I was just thinking about that case. And the idea that you have to look for peripheral reasons of law-breaking when it comes to a moral violation there, to me, this is what's wrong with the law. They're not out for justice to what is right and wrong according to biblical standards. There's too much according to what the lawmaker says is right or wrong, which many times is way off base. And clearly, if someone is in charge of their vehicle, whether they're in charge of it or not, their responsibility, I mean, if they're impaired or not, doesn't matter. It's their responsibility. If they kill someone in that vehicle because of violating one of the rules of the road, they should be held responsible. Now, that may not be murder, but it definitely is some type of manslaughter. And I'm telling you, this is one of the problems in our society. They've turned away from the fear of God and the biblical standards of right and wrong, and they've been making up right and wrong on their own, and they're doing a bad job. And that's why a lot of people are upset, because you have lawmakers that are changing rules of right and wrong and lessening crime. Especially, I mean, I think Ray Larson agrees with the fact when you have a criminal that comes in and breaks in your house, but because he doesn't have a gun, he's just cited by the police when the guy holds him at gunpoint and he's sent on home. There's something terribly, terribly wrong with that.
All right, we're running out of time. Let's get some comments on this. You bring up some good points, Doug. I'll let you hang up and listen to the answer. All right, you're a Christian. How does this all fit in with the Bible and with the law? You don't, even though you're a Christian, you don't have anything to do with the Bible in your job, do you?
Well, we can't. We got to. We're talking about definitions on behavior, and the law tells us what we can do. And I may or may not agree with what the law is, but I'm legally bound to. By the law,
yeah,
and these definitions are something we're stuck with. Like I said, I may not agree with them, but that's what we got.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I think a lot of people probably feel the way Doug does, but
I do too.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah,
all right. A minute and a half, Ray.
Well, I want to. We were talking about a couple of things. One of them is. What are the intersections in town, Ron, that are heavy duty accident kind of intersections?
Just right off the top of my head, without having a list in front of me, we've got Nicholasville and Reynolds Road is always a problem area. High Street and Upper Street, and Maxwell and Upper is one that I get a lot of complaints about. Red light running in particular, and we had a lot of bad accidents there. A lot of bad collisions there. I remember in particular one that we worked a few years ago up there at that intersection, and the car actually was knocked into the building up there, and the owner of the building and that business there, I've talked to her personally.
Is that Bella Rose?
Yes.
Yeah. My son-in-law works across the street at that bike shop, and he says there's almost never a week that goes by that there's not only an accident, but a serious accident there.
Yeah.
I wonder why.
Some of it, I think, is... There's some visibility issues there. There's the building that comes right out to the corner of the street, and there's really nothing that can be done about that building in there. And then, like I said, the red light running issue in that area. And we have a list of those intersections that are high collision areas and more prone for red light running, and we try to focus our enforcement efforts on those areas.
Thank you for being with us. Thank you all. Thank you, Ray. See you next week. Okay.